Bishopville County Planning Commission to order and ask that we have a roll call, please.
Commissioner Gibson?
Here.
Commissioner Rappa? Commissioner Melskow? Commissioner Christie?
Here.
Chairman Rose?
Here.
Let it be noted that Commissioners Rappa and Melskow are absent.
All right, and thank you very much. Could we now all please stand for a flag salute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Now is the time for public comment, an opportunity for the public to comment on anything that's not on the agenda. And the agendas are available in the back of the room in that little wooden box on the left-hand side. There are also speaker slips there. If you wish to speak, I'd ask that you be so kind as to fill out a speaker slip. Therefore, we can get your name spelled right and get you all in the right order. I have one speaker slip. Julie Tacker.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos. Thank you. A mailer is going around to the homes in Los Osos. It looks like this. It says, which would you prefer for downtown? A beautiful passive park that protects our water supply, solves our pollution problem, and preserves our views. Or a 35-foot-tall shopping center blocking our views of the Rock, the Bay, and the Moros. It goes on to say, the Resource Park will ensure open space downtown. The wastewater project, called the Resource Park, will be an asset, stopping pollution of our drinking water and protecting the Bay. The location was previously zoned commercial retail, allowing for 35-foot-tall buildings at the street, just like Ralph's, which would have blocked the views of the Rock and the Bay. If the project isn't built there, we could end up with a strip mall. Well, I'm not the expert. You are the planners. You are the experts. And from what I have read, I don't believe that this scenario of a strip mall at that site is possible. Through my research, through the documents that you use, first of all, the project, any project in Los Osos, coming any development in the future will have to comply with the coastal development permit for the sewer, which includes the conditions 34 and 76. 34, water, sustainable water supply in Los Osos has yet to be determined. 76 is our habitat conservation plan. Both will have to be comprehensive and incorporated into the Estero Area Plan update, which is at the Coastal Commission right now in its draft form. What I remember from the Estero Area draft and this panel and the Board of Supervisors is that we approved buildings to be no taller than 28 feet. What I also remember about Tri-W is that it's mapped ESHA. Today it's scarred by bulldozers, but it remains Baywood Fine Sand. Baywood Fine Sand is sustainable for coastal scrub, and that is our ESHA. So I believe that whatever project is developed at that site, it would have to comply with the Coastal Act, which would have to protect ESHA. It would have to be Tri-W is visually significant in that it does have views of the Rock and the Bay, and again, that development, whatever it is, would have to protect those. So this postcard is misleading to my community. I'm disappointed that it made its way to every doorstep, and because the planning process is so complicated, I don't believe that most people would understand that this just couldn't happen. Furthermore, the property belongs to the Los Osos Community Services District. The board of directors takes direction from the people of Los Osos. What happens to that property with its sale, that's up to them. And they're going to tell their board what to do with Tri-W should Tuesday's recall election prevail. So I just thank you for your time, and if you could confirm for me that what I think to be true, I would surely appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else for public comment?
Cambria, but if we don't deal with the other cities, we're sometimes missing out. So we're going to be making a real strong effort to increase the coordination efforts between the cities and the county and the state. So that is our first meeting on the 15th, and just for people that aren't going to attend those, I know the chair might be interested in the one in Templeton, which will be on the next weekend, October 22nd, at the Templeton Middle School, the same place where we had the last one. And then on November 5th, we'll be at the Grace Church in Rio Grande, and then wrapping up in Morro Bay on November 19th. And so with that, I think that's the only thing I had, unless Mr. Jansen looks like he's coming to the podium.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Matt Jansen. Warren Hogue wanted me to add a couple items to Mr. Ufrat's update list, and that was that at your next hearing, you'll have some of the dates for your retreat, some solid dates for your retreat. He'll have that at your next hearing for you to talk about. And then the second meeting in November, which falls Thanksgiving week, we're looking at scheduling for the 30th. And based on what Warren told me this morning, it looks like a date that we can catch 4 out of 5 of you, and we don't know yet about Gene, but because of the backlog of projects, it's a date that we would like to secure and go forward with if it works for the majority of the commission. So those are two things that Warren wanted me to add.
Excellent.
Okay, and as to Ms. Tacker's comment, was she correct in saying that there is no approved project, shopping center kind of a thing? Am I correct in assuming they would have to meet all the coastal development rules? Well, this is a no-brainer. I know you can answer this.
John Ufrat, planning staff, yes. I mean, if a different project came in for that site, it clearly would need a new coastal development permit that would be processed through the county, you know, unless appealed to the Coastal Commission, which is what happened with the sewer project. But the sewer project is the only valid coastal development permit for that piece of property at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Seeing none, I'll move on to our first hearing item. Could we introduce that, Madam Secretary?
Continued hearing to consider a request by County of San Luis Obispo to 1. Update and amend the Cambria and San Simeon Acres Community Plan portions of the North Coast Area Plan. Number 2. Amend the Cambria Design Plan. Number 3. Amend the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance. Title 23. County file number LRP 2004-00024. Supervisorial District 2, Martha Nieder, Project Manager.
Thank you, Commissioners. At your last hearing, the Commission completed tentative approval for the community-wide standards section of Chapter 7 of the plan. Today, continuing on with Chapter 7 in order to break it up into parts that we can get through and make decisions on, I thought I would introduce the commercial service, recreation, and residential multifamily planning area standards and give it back to your commission. We can go through those sections, and then if there's time remaining, we can continue on with the residential single family standards. The commercial service planning area standards, changes in this section mainly consist of clarifications. For the recreation land use category, changes to this section mainly consist of cleanup and deletion of a number of standards related to the Cambria Pines Lodge property, which most of those have been implemented through the issuance of a coastal development permit that involves the entire area. For the residential multifamily land use category, the area standards include, or changes to the area standards include, a density reduction from 26 units per acre to 15 units per acre for sites greater than 1 acre. For sites less than 1 acre, the existing density is 15 units per acre. This section also relates to a map change, which you've received numerous comments on. If Ramona will bring up the PowerPoint. Map change. Proposed.
While she's doing that, let's find out. We're starting on page 752 of the new book, and would be on what page for the old book?
749.
Okay.
There's a proposed map change for Tract 226, which is currently in the commercial retail land use category, and the proposal is to change it to residential multifamily. Patterns are oftentimes either due to owner preference or lack of water or other constraints. Many of the comment letters that you've received talk about the potential impact to noise, traffic, and wildlife on the area should development on this site occur. And the planning area standards in this section specifically address these issues by requiring a development plan approval for the entire tract that deals with issues such as access, land use, circulation, maintenance, and design. And further, the environmental review conducted when development is proposed would address these issues as well. That concludes staff's comments on the commercial service, recreation, and residential multifamily planning area standards.
Could you go back to that Track 226 and give us kind of a history, what was originally envisioned and how it came to be that we're changing that vision? Or considering changing that vision?
I think John Hofshore can best provide that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, John Hofshore, County Planning Staff. This property does have a long history on it. Just a few bullets. The county found this in commercial retail zoning back in 1980 when we developed our first land use element, land use ordinance. And at that time, we proposed changing it from commercial to residential. And that effort failed. The property owners at the time wanted to develop something in terms of a light commercial, neighborhood commercial types of uses, including gas stations and highway commercial types of things. You can see Highway 1's right there at the bottom of your map. We came back in 1984. Again, the same property owners wanted to keep it commercial. So with the first coastal plan, it was left as commercial. When we started the last round of updates, which I believe this one came in approximately 1992, the owners came to us and they realized that the commercial wasn't viable. And one of the property owners, who was also a housing, affordable housing type of expert and architect, he did some preliminary plans, and you may see some of those in your packet, architectural drawings of row houses and so forth. And anyway, that was a major shift in 1992 where the property owners no longer wanted commercial and they were more interested in residential. The county picked up on that and we included them in the first update of this plan. As you know, that never got adopted, although not because of this. So I think the general idea, the consensus that's followed through is that nobody wants commercial in this location, and now it's a question of what is the appropriate residential use. Is it residential multifamily? Is it single family? Is it a mix of open space and multifamily? Or who knows? And I think that's the realm of the discussion right now. Several of these lots, I believe, have meter positions. They cannot develop. In fact, the reason you see it vacant right now is that you can't put a primary residential structure on a commercial designated parcel under the county's rules. So that's why you see it vacant. And that's part of the impetus that now the property owners would like to see it changed to residential, because that will take down that barrier. So. And I'm available if you have any further questions on this.
Thank you, Mr. Hofshore. Can you tell us what is the vegetation type in the sort of lower right-hand corner of the property? It's I can't really tell if that's like oak trees or scrub or
I believe that's
what's
mostly
going on there.
That there are any Monterey pines in this, although I may be misspeaking because I think I see one on the left side that's on the property line.
Is there any combining designation over this property, or is it?
My guess is it's probably archaeologically sensitive, as is most of this end of town. But we didn't, through the years of looking at this property, we don't know of any known constraints. And it's mostly either flat or very gently sloping. You can see it's got a road on one side. And the original subdividers, this is actually a pre-existing cluster subdivision, if you know, developed long before the county ever envisioned clustering, because you could see the small lots with the loop road and then the large open space lot in the center. And the property owners, the small lot owners, all own undivided interest in that one. Again, it's a very classic cluster subdivision.
Have you investigated the nature of deed restrictions or other, restrictions to the uses of those?
I don't think your mic is on.
Well, I thought it was.
You'll agree
that work? Has that worked better? There we go.
Oh, yeah.
Have you investigated any?
We would, the county, as these are vacant, would allow a dwelling unit on each two lots. Each pair would produce one house in the development scenario. Having said that, there's several in there that are in single ownership, and my suspicions are there might be a couple singles that could also develop. So the 33 lots may produce 15 to 20 potential houses at best.
Under single family.
Actually, under just about any designation that's residential.
Okay. And have these been subject to the lot consolidation process at all?
That's correct. And that's why I'm using the interpretation. These are vacant. They're less than 3,500 square feet. They don't have the frontage.
So the actual ownership pattern here isn't exactly what we see there, because we should be erasing some of the common lines on some of those.
Yes. And right. And some of them, property owners do own pairs. But there's a couple singles in there the last time I looked.
Mr. Hofscher, under what scenario, you mentioned that some of those lots could be developed as single lots. Under what scenario could that happen? I thought you needed to have two 25-foot lots in order to develop.
If the lot was in separate ownership in that exact configuration, which would be 25 by 70 feet, and if it existed prior to the county's lot consolidation ordinance, which was approximately 1967-68, they would be legal lots.
If the ownership predated 1967.
Right, if it was in that configuration. So there could be a number of owners selling, but as long as they kept it in the 25 by 70 configuration, we would honor that as a legal lot.
Because even if somebody purchased a 25-foot lot last year, in that configuration, they could develop it as a single lot?
That's correct, if that's all they purchased. If they bought the one next door, then they would consolidate, and the two would equal one house. But I believe there's a couple in there that in any scenario. In fact, the scenario I'm talking about is true over across the highway in Lodge Hill, mm-hmm. too. There's still a few buildable 25-footers left that simply have remained in estates and family ownerships, and nobody's ever done anything with them. Thank you.
Before you leave, there was, I believe, some of our correspondents has suggested that this be zoned open space and left as open space. Could you comment on why you didn't do that?
The difficulty with open space on the entire site, and that would be the whole area bounded by your yellow line there, is that you almost wouldn't be doing anything. The building potential would remain because you can still build a caretaker's dwelling on an open space designated lot. And the number of potential houses here is dictated by those white lines on your map rather than politically what designation the county puts on it in terms of residential. We've heard two things. One group, I believe, and they can add on to this, but I think one scenario is that the whole thing go to open space and that there be some initiative to try to buy some of these out that all haven't already been bought for open space purposes. And that would include the small lots and the large lots. The other scenario is respecting that those small lots exist and that under a residential designation, the county would allow them to develop according to the rules. But that large lot in the middle that clearly is the open space lot, that would be designated OS. So you'd see two designations on this, residential and open space. So there's basically two on the table that that I've been able to understand. And I think throughout this, everybody wants to find something else other than the commercial retail designation. And I've seen the site looked for a potential school site. I've seen it looked for just about everything. But I think the consensus is to do something definitive about that commercial zoning because it wouldn't be appropriate to develop that way, and it's too close to the highway in terms of potential there.
So if I understood you right, if we poof made the whole thing open space, we would still have the same number of possible home sites as if we in fact made it residential multifamily.
That's my feeling. If you did not add anything additionally, like a minimum lot size or some other type of thing that we haven't talked about yet. But really, the build-out potential on this is established by the existing underlying lots rather than what staff or the Planning Commission or the board may choose in terms of what type of residential zoning. And you really just have two types there. It's either going to be multifamily or single family. And I think that that's important because there's the perception in the neighborhood around it.
Should work with the property owners in Tract 226 to re-subdivide the lots with no net addition of lots for multifamily or mixed-use project. And what could happen if this were a multifamily land use category and you look at the entire site is there's potential for doing some attached or some detached or different types of housing units while preserving some open space, doing some common access. So you're really looking at some more flexibility with how this is developed. You're not held to the lot pattern that's on there on the ground today, and it can look in some creativity in addressing the neighborhood concerns at the same time looking at the development of the area.
And we would expect that one or all of the property owners would bring forward that application. That wouldn't be a county-generated application.
Well, the way the standard is written right now, it requires prior to any development or land division, a development plan shall be approved for the entire tract, including each ownership within the tract, and staff would recommend taking out including each ownership. But it would be approved for the entire track, so it would encompass everything that's going to happen in that track and looking at a comprehensive development for it rather than kind of a piecemeal, small lot by small lot.
Mm-hmm. And why would you strike the including each ownership?
Just some potential legal issues with if one property owner is trying to hold out and not agree to the development plan. We think even without that, we can still require looking at that development plan to look at the entire tract, but we wouldn't necessarily have to have each ownership sign the dotted line.
And the dotted line would be the application for the development
permit? Right.
Okay.
Realistically speaking, as a staff planner, what do you think the chances, the likelihood of that actually coming to pass?
Well,
we're a betting man.
The ownership patterns in this area is such that there's certain property owners that own multiple lots. So when someone would come in to develop, we would look to getting everybody involved. Those that, if there's a couple properties here or there that want to hold out, you know, we'd have to adjust to that. But because of the ownership patterns, we think that there would be enough to actually make a difference and to have some flexibility to work with the different patterns and affect development so that it is the least impactful to the neighborhood and the habitat there. It is, even though there isn't a lot of Monterey pine trees there, it is within the terrestrial habitat combining designation. So we would look at preserving maybe some chunks of open area and concentrating development, or, you know, really looking at it on a comprehensive basis.
So you feel confident that the county would have the ability to basically re-subdivide the parcel over the objections of some individual lot owners there?
Well, the county would have to respect the objections of the property owners, but say there are three property owners who don't want to re-subdivide or don't want anything done with the lots, but the other, you know, 30 lots are open, that's still an opportunity to have that configuration move, whereas you might now just have, you know, three lots in the original configuration. There is some flexibility with the balance of the lots there.
It sounds, even under the best case scenario, like a problematic exercise.
Well, especially with the undivided interest in the common lot area. I mean, anything that gets done there seems to. I mean, I guess I would go back and I'd be interested in county council's response that, you know that the plan should suggest a consensus, and if we can put that each ownership within the tract, I think that's even cleaner, because it doesn't appear to me that anything's going to happen there until such consensus is reached.
I'm Tim McNulty with the county council's office. I think the planning commission is looking at this in about the right way. The application for a subdivision here would require, at its initial receipt by the planning department, the consent of everyone with an interest in the property. And so until we get there, and that would include the big, large common area in the center. So it will be quite difficult to affect a re-subdivision of the lot without the agreement of all the landowners there.
So if one property owner who had a interest in the common lot said, no, I don't want to do anything, that's it, nothing happens?
Effectively, I think so, because, you know, at the initial point where we receive one of these applications and determine whether or not it's complete.
Is that a potential, though? I mean, is that something the county could consider?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the obviously you would need some legitimate government purpose to condemn the property, but that could be the provision of a more highly residential housing project on an infill lot or something
right.
like that.
Right. I mean, hypothetically, if we were going to zone this multifamily because Cambria needs more residential multifamily, and that seems like we can make findings for that, but if that seems like the most straightforward way to get from point A to point B, is there any constraint that we don't know about that would prevent that from happening?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And I wonder, Mr. Chairman, as we transition toward public comment, if we could get the advisory council in with any comments first on this.
I'd like that, and I'm glad to see we have a representative here.
Yes.
Do you want to weigh in on this commercial service, recreation, multifamily, Track 226?
Thank you. Well, we haven't had a
got to give your name, though.
Yes, Ann Wyatt. I'm chair of North Coast Advisory Council. And, yes, we have had some discussion on this tract area, but not actually a whole lot. We have had a few property owners come and voice concern about having the rezoning to multifamily. And we did hear that there was some interest in zoning either open space or, I guess, at most, single-family residential. So we didn't actually take any council action on the matter. So that just a couple of public comments heard.
Okay, thanks. Okay, this is a public hearing. I'll open up the public to speak. And again, we're talking on commercial service, recreation, and multifamily, which multifamily does include that controversial Track 226. And the first speaker I have is Daryl Robinson. Yeah, I'll keep you there. How about Roland Sosi, followed by Iona Sosi. And they're wanted to weigh in on commercial service and residential multifamily. And maybe, Ms. Nieder, if you could help Mr. Sosi with that mic there. Followed by Iona, and then Barbara Shippey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, the members of East Lodge Hill.
Okay, you got to say your name, sir.
Sorry, Roland Susie, Cambria. The members of the East Lodge Hill Residents Association strongly oppose the action to rezone all 4 acres of 226 from commercial retail to residential multifamily. The association is comprised today of 26 families residing in the immediate area surrounding Tract 226. Today you'll hear testimony from some of our members on topics ranging from traffic congestion, noise pollution, wildlife eradication, safety issues, and potential runoff problems. 49 residents in the surrounding neighborhood have signed and submitted a petition to the Planning Department requesting that you rezone 226 as either open space or residential single family. To begin, we recommend that Lot 34, commonly referred to as the common area in the subdivision, be rezoned as open space. Our association members want Tract 226 rezoned residential family or open space because there are 37 residential single family homes on the streets in the immediate neighborhood of Tract 226. Built on lots with two water meters, retiring one of the two water meters in the process. These residential single-family homes were constructed on lots designated multifamily with full approval of county planners. In addition, 17 multifamily homes were constructed. The homes immediately surrounding Tract 226 are now single-family by an overwhelming margin. The residents are concerned that a large multifamily compound will result in unsafe traffic conditions on the two roads used for ingress and egress and noise pollution. The lots should be bought up either by association members or by a land conservancy organization. The ultimate goal would be to retire them and rezone the entire tract as open space. Beginning in the year 2000, members of the East Lodge Hill Residents Association started purchasing lots. Their sole purpose was the expectation that they would have a voice in the disposition of Tract 226. To date, 6 lots have been purchased. Once the tract is rezoned open space, these lots would be voluntarily retired. I'd like to show you the idea that the planner had for this 33 lots in the plan for any open space whatsoever in this proposed development.
Thank you. Your 3 minutes are up. And
all right. So I would thank you for your understanding.
Thank you for your comments. Iona Susi.
Hi, my name is Iona Susi from Cambria. There are just several residents' concerns that we have for changing this property into multifamily units. On page 4-1A of the plan update draft environmental impact report, the land use changes on East Lodge Hill would allow residential development consistent with residential uses. Well, there are 37 single-family homes there and just 17 multifamily dwellings, and that seems hardly consistent with the existing use of the land. Aesthetic changes, I think, would be considerable. Right now, it provides a very peaceful ambience, and we have deer there, we have birds there, and just hearing the abrasive sounds that would be coming from multifamily housing, I think, would be very different aesthetically. I have talked to several owners who are very concerned about the reduction in their property values if this goes into effect for residential multifamily. And I think it is significant that you do have letters from many of the residents and also a petition signed by 49 of the residents who really would like to keep some semblance of open space in this area. We really don't have a lot of open space. We have the new school now. We have the Cambria Pines Lodge with their additional buildings, and they propose a theater there. There's only two ways out of this tract, and I just think it would be a mess. So thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.
I have a question, actually, for Ms.
Sosi. Ms. Sosi, a question for you. Could you come back to the microphone when the commissioner has a question for you?
Thank you, Ms. Sosi. Are you involved with the effort to purchase some of these parcels for open space dedication?
Yeah, we have two. We own two lots.
So, and a total of how many have been purchased to date for that purpose?
Six out of
33.
Yeah.
Are you working with a land trust or the Coastal Conservancy?
Yes, we have approached several agencies. At this point, we haven't had any positive results, but we're going to pursue that and hoping they can help us retire some of these lots, so buy them out.
Have you given any thought to the potential? I'm assuming that the previous speaker was your husband.
Yes.
And he was requesting that it be rezoned either open space or single family, residential single family. If it were rezoned residential single family per your request, have you given any thought to what that might do to the affordability of your efforts to purchase these lots and retire them?
Yes. It's really not the money for us. We want to keep this as a peaceful area to live in without.
But if it were zoned single family, mm-hmm. and you still wanted to purchase those lots for open space, my guess would be that they would be quite a bit more expensive,
yes,
because now they would be essentially buildable lots, or they would at least be, you know, in line to a water meter.
Yes, we have. Yeah.
So in terms of that effort, have you given any thought to maybe just leaving it zoned the way it is, which essentially makes it, you know, for all intents and purposes, unbuildable?
Right. Yes, we have thought of that.
So would that be something that the folks in that neighborhood would be supporting? Just leaving the zoning as it is, so you could continue with your lot by lot purchase efforts at an affordable rate?
You know, we haven't really talked to a lot of the owners about that, but it is certainly a thought that
it might be
gone through our mind
kick around
to just leave it as it is. So
okay.
Thank you. Barbara Shippey, followed by Joy Fitchew.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Shippey. My husband and I live on Wood Drive. Our backyard backs up into Tract 226, and we also own two lots of 226. We originally bought it in 2000. If Tract 226 is developed, as proposed on page 761 of the revised copy, one of the concerns of the East Lodge Hills residents is the impact of traffic congestion and safety issues. The community is already surrounded. This added to the existing blind spot east of Patterson Road on Burton Drive creates serious safety issues. In Chapter 3, page 3-33, there was a reference made to the state of tourist traffic on Burton Drive and Main Street. It reads, "In the summer months, tourist traffic increases substantially on Main Street, Burton Drive, and Moonstone Beach. Both Burton Drive and Main Street are at capacity year-round." In Chapter 5-2, reference was also made to Burton Drive. This collector road provides major access from Lodge Hill. Operational improvements are necessary to keep the level of service from deteriorating further at Lodge Hill develops with more homes. The current road condition in East Lodge Hill and above named exits already show wear and tear. This consists of potholes and uneven pavement. Repairing, repaving, and maintaining these roads is a current issue with us. The roads cannot handle any additional traffic that will come from the proposal development of parcel tract 226. I appreciate your time and efforts, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Man, that's perfect timing. You finished exactly on 3 minutes. Very good. I must compliment all of the speakers have been very good about keeping in their 3 minutes. And Joy Fitzhugh, followed by Robert Rippey.
Good morning, Joy Fitzhugh. Martha, could you pull up the map while I'm talking? The map of 226 will show you a portion. I'm speaking somewhat personally and somewhat for Farm Bureau. If Martha will bring the pointer down the right side a little further, there, whoops, up into that gray dark area, the dark, there you go. This is one of the consequences of development and impermeable surfaces. Currently, with all the residences that are in this area, we have a runoff problem that has actually forced us to put a sediment basin on the ranch and to have erosion control methods that we've had to put in with the current development. And taking a slightly different tack from what has been spoken about on 226, if this is developed and a significant amount of impermeable surface is put in this area, it's going to exacerbate this problem significantly. Now, our family, over the last few numbers of years, actually, has tried with regional water, has tried with County Public Works, which when it was engineering, and various other agencies to have a solution from the development issues of runoff. And if you will notice on new page 765 in the new document, you talk about erosion control. Unfortunately, if you allow multi-residential here and whether the developer has garages in the center, open space or not, this erosion control section is going to be inadequate to take care of the situation. And as a very recent issue, when you put impermeable surfaces and don't take care of it properly, as with the new grammar school, we had 10 times the sediment go down the creek that's off the map here as what happened in, as what happened in previous years. And the reason we know this is because under agriculture and because where the little dotted trees are, that's our orchard, we have an irrigated ag discharge waiver. And so we have been monitoring the sediment and the nutrients that come down through our ranch. And what is interesting is because of development, we had 10 times the sediment this year coming off of the school site. You can imagine what might happen as you have development there and you'd have impermeable surfaces. One of the other issues that we have that has been happening because of the low-income housing, and I'm not against the low-income housing, but we found out that the phosphates, the only phosphates going into our creek, is coming right out of the development, the low-income housing and the junior high. So you're going to have an additional problem with that. So we're really strongly urging you to, if you can't create some much lower density impermeable surface residential density there, you have got to increase the erosion control situation. Where I would come in speaking more as Farm Bureau is this is not a unique situation in our county where you have agriculture up next to residential. Unfortunately, almost all the houses on the street on Eaton Road, the county allowed them to pipe their runoff to the street, which goes onto our land. Thank you.
Okay, I had a question. Could you guide Ms. Nieder into showing on the map where the drainage flow is?
Sure.
In this
all the drainage flow goes onto, that is a sloping area, sloping to McLeod Way. So all the drainage is going to go down to McLeod Way, flow down Wood Drive, and there is right just before you get to, okay.
Wood. I really don't have, I'm in total agreement with the previous speakers. I don't really have anything to add to this, and so I'm going to yield my time as I feel it's been said. Thank you.
Okay. I see we are getting another speaker here.
Yeah. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I forgot to fill out the request form, but I'll fill it out and turn it in.
That would be nice.
Okay. John Belcher, and I'm here speaking on behalf of Joe Lindsay, who is unable to make it this morning due to a death in the family. And but he asked me to come and speak a little bit about McLeod Way and the project, the track that you have up on the screen. I guess you have it in front of you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have little nice little computers here. We're not ignoring you. We're looking at our screens.
I'm the one who has to keep looking up. Okay. Track 226. This property has been the subject of review by the Coastal Commission staff and the planning staff for a number of years. It's been zoned commercial, as you probably know, and the plan is to have this become zoned RMF, and we certainly endorse that. We think that's a good thing for Cambria, and so do, I think, by and large, the planning staff and the recommendations that we see in front of us here. There's a peculiar thing about this track that you should be aware, maybe you already are aware, is that I believe it's, is it 33 lots? It's, does anybody? Mm-hmm. 33 lots, and they have a common common area that's shared in the middle and the layout that's in front of you. Somehow, when this was all owned by one person, the original standard got put into the plan that said that prior to any development, a master plan shall be approved for the entire tract. My client owns maybe about half of the lots in this project area, but it may not be possible to get all property owners to sign up and apply for a single development plan for the entire property. So I think it is appropriate that there be a development plan or some type of planning document that's approved in connection with the development of the property, but to require each and every parcel to join in the application would create a situation of a holdout and possibly a stalemate, and it's quite possible that nothing will ever happen here because of this requirement in the plan, which I think is very unusual. And I don't think achieves it will. I don't think it will achieve the purpose of that it's intended. So we agree with the recommendations that you see here. I think that the open space in the area in the middle provides a great opportunity for a park and for drainage control as well.
Anybody ready to summarize theirs?
Yes. So I would ask you to consider approving the recommendation for the rezoning, and to endorse the concept of allowing individual property owners to apply for planning approval within this rather than having every single property owner sign up.
Thank you.
And leaving the area in the middle available for parklands and drainage.
Thank you. That means I'm trying to get you to sit down. Any others? Public comment? Seeing none, I'll close the public comment period and bring it back to the commission. But before we do that, I thought I'd maybe we could talk briefly about our schedule. I see there's people here for later projects, and I think it was understood between Ms. Nieder and I, at least, that we would do the this Cambria-San Simeon plan until noon, break at noon, and then start our other projects after noon. Is that our consensus of the commission?
The agenda show that we have 3 hours set aside for that. That seems to be
okay.
The right amount.
So if you're here for any project other than the Cambria-San Simeon plan, you might go have lunch. Okay. Now we're back to us. Ms. Nieder or somebody from staff, could you comment on this proposal? Let's make it residential single family. Would that change anything? And I kind of understood Mr. Hofshire to say that the lot pattern really controlled everything. We could make it open space, we could make it residential, multifamily, single family, but it's still going to be that lot pattern. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chairman, John Hofshore, County Planning Staff. Yes, the lot pattern's not going to change with whatever action we take today or ultimately. The building potential is defined by the lot pattern.
What would it mean if we made it residential single family? How would that change anything?
It would not change. Residential multifamily and residential single family, there's no change. Let me fill you in on something I didn't share earlier. I think the fear is the large open space lot in the middle. Could it be sold? It's at least 2 acres under our proposal to go on one of those legal lots. So hopefully I've simplified that rather than confused it further.
Okay. When we get to it, we may...
One more question.
Sure.
Mr. Hofshore, would a duplex qualify as multifamily on one of those parcels?
Yes.
In the multifamily category, yes.
So when we're thinking multifamily, we might be thinking, you know, a condominium complex or, you know, something along those lines. But in fact, we could end up with a series of individually owned duplexes.
And I think that's something to point out is that although the density would be the same, some of the development patterns with multifamily may be a little more flexible to allow a duplex or...
I'm just thinking that probably doesn't go as far as we're thinking we might need to go in terms of if we're going with the multifamily zoning, that might not meet our conceptual needs for that site.
But at this point, we could also, I mean, right now there are 33 lots nominally commercial service, but that really does set an upper bound on how many residential units are envisioned. I mean, that common area was never envisioned as a developed area in looking at how they go about it. So, I mean, we could also set a maximum number of dwelling units that should ever occupy that tract.
Or
not
a minimum number.
Right. I guess I'm, since we're back in discussion here, I'm leaning toward the idea that the requirement of a development plan for the entire tract is the proper mechanism to get these things sorted out. Everything we talk about, the density, the style, the issues with traffic would be addressed under the extensive review. I mean, the development plan is our highest level of permitting. And each and every one of those things would be addressed. I would expect that a development plan for that entire tract would require an EIR, given the scale of it, but at least a serious initial study that would touch on all the issues that are of concern to the community. And I think the other aspect, what I hear from County Council, is that the inseparability of ownership in that center parcel as it relates to the development plan is a really important concept because it does in the end require some level of consensus to get this to move forward.
I agree that a development plan is the way to go in terms of setting the density and the design. I just don't think we're ever going to get a development plan out of that parcel the way it's currently configured because you've got so many owners with such divergent opinions of what should go forward there. We could rezone it, we could require a development plan, but again, if we as a council have a particular idea about what should happen on that property, I don't think we're going to get there
well, I guess
through that plan. Through
tell you what, and I was at fault because I asked the question, and
yeah,
I really
and
I should have said, let's start with commercial service.
Three votes for that.
Okay. And then we'll get back to this discussion, and
yeah.
it ain't over. So commercial service on page 752 on the new or 749 on the old. Does anybody have anything they'd like to change there? Are we happy with that page? Which is commercial service limitation on use, permit requirements, and design standards. Seeing none, I'll move us on to recreation, which is the next page. We had permit requirements, location criteria, limitation on use, Moonstone Beach.
If the clerk would bring the pages up.
And make it big. Thank you. I'm not hearing anything, so I'm moving on to the next page, which starts with signs. And signs is B. And then we go down to C. Looks like that was deleted. So then we have D, exterior building materials, which I guess should become the new C.
Yeah, I would have to redo that.
Okay. Well, it goes on through it, and I presume you can figure that out in the privacy of your office. So exterior building materials and colors and height limitation, landscaping requirements. Man, we're moving along here. Road improvements, site coverage, view corridors required. Cambria Pines Lodge.
Okay.
All right.
I'm just wondering why we're calling. Maybe staff can give us a little history as to what's consistent with its use.
Well, it is consistent with the recreation land use category. No matter what land use category I think you would change this to, there would still be limitations on use.
Because you've gone in and spotted those of Table O that are appropriate, and the real concern was its proximity to the residential areas, if I remember the issues up there.
Okay.
Okay, the next page, 722, Cambria Pines Lodge, and the following standards apply to the property as shown in Figure 722. That's not working for me. And do I have to hold this up to a mirror to read it? Things look backwards.
Yeah, I don't know if that happened in the conversion or what, but we'd have to fix that graphic.
And do we? Because I don't see the lodge on there at all. Or do you have a better graphic that would point that out?
Are you looking for maybe a site plan with the buildings on, or?
I don't know. I just want to find the darn thing.
Well, you see where what's in the shaded area. You see where Burton Drive is, where it says Burton Drive toward the about the middle of the bottom border of the of Figure 722.
I can't read anything.
I just know. I just know Cambria. So the shaded area is the area that's covered by Cambria Pines Lodge. It goes on both sides of Patterson Way, and Burton Drive wraps around on the upper right-hand corner as it heads down to the village.
Okay, maybe we could have a little area that or arrow that points to it, or so someone unfamiliar with Cambria would say, "Okay, this is what we're talking about."
Okay, and this
my comment is just fix the graphic,
okay,
and we'll just let it go with that. However you want to do it. So we're moving on to well, I have a call for a bathroom break, and it's close to 5:02, so we can do that. So we'll come back at 10 after and start limitation on use and permit requirements.
Boots on. She's been, you know.
I'm not messing with a lady with boots on, okay? Okay. And we have a quorum again. I'll call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission back to order. And we were on page 756, recreation, limitation on use, west of Patterson Way.
Sorry, I'm trying to turn my phone off, and it's not responding.
And I appreciate you turning your phone off, because you've got an unusual ring, too. It's kind of... Of course, I guess that goes just about everybody. It has one. Run new 756. Okay. Recreation, limitation on use, permit requirements. And then we had a whole bunch of deletions. And a lot of deletions. And now we're down to Patrick House, bed and breakfast. Now we're going to hit residential multifamily.
Okay, let's stop there.
Oh, you want to stop it there?
Yeah, I think we probably have to stop there.
But you did allow us to finish recreation.
Yep.
Okay. So let's deal with the other issues before we get to track 226.
Okay. I have a question right off the top in 1A that... Ms. Nieder mentioned in her presentation as well that we're limiting the density to 15 units per acre in RMF zoning, and that's down from 26. It's still 26 in San Simeon. Why are we decreasing density for RMF?
And
why are you suggesting that we should?
It's just a decrease in density on RMF parcels larger than 1 acre, and part of that is the build-out reduction strategies that CCSD is working towards and the county is attempting to work with.
How many parcels zoned RMF that are larger than an acre do we have in Cambria?
I don't know at this point. one of the challenges that we have in Cambria is that even if a residential multifamily property was an acre in size, typically there's so many constraints on those parcels, such as slope, sensitive habitat, or so on, that really actually make the 26 units per acre typically infeasible to achieve. So,
well, if we're not setting a minimum, I mean, we're not saying, you know, it has to be at least a certain density, I don't really know that we gain anything by, you know, reducing the maximum, other than the fact that we're reducing our...
The new revised version of Chapter 7, and I don't see that...
I agree.
Written that's, that way.
That's struck out in B.
Yeah.
It's shown as strikeout.
Right.
Because the proposal is that residential density in multifamily shall not exceed 15 units per acre, period.
Okay. So that's the standard you want to you're proposing to
that's
apply to all of RMF throughout Cambria.
So that
Correct.
Would be greater than an acre or less than an acre? It would just
right.
be 15.
Okay.
Track 226.
And, right.
The maximum density would be 15 units per acre.
And the reason for doing that was to take a whack at bringing the build out down to where it can reasonably be. And the question, I guess, is does given the amount of land zone RMF, does the 15 units per acre, you know, how many residential multifamily units might we expect to be able to produce in Cambria under this density and the amount of land zone for that?
I don't have that in front of me, how much that change actually reduces. We can come back
yeah.
to your commission with that.
Again, I look at Cambria as all of our communities, but Cambria in particular as a special case because of the resource constraints. It's not like a city that might grow indefinitely into the future where you'd like to make sure you're assuring density. I mean, there are a certain number of dwelling units that are going to go into Cambria. We have a pretty clear idea how much that's going to be. Whether they're tightly packed or less tightly packed doesn't seem to be quite the issue here that it would be if we didn't have those constraints.
I guess I look at Cambria as a special case as well, including its limitations on resources. The other thing that's sort of unique about Cambria is the degree to which it's dependent on service jobs. And the low-income or, less high-end wage earners that typically fill those jobs. And Cambria right now is unusually strapped for affordable housing. We've got, families, three, four, and five families living together in a single-family residence, which is putting a great deal of stress on the infrastructure in other ways. So I think because Cambria is kind of behind the curve in terms of the amount of affordable housing that it has to offer, and because it is so heavily weighted toward the need for those type of workers to serve the activities in that community, and because multifamily housing, while not automatically affordable, is generally considered to be affordable. I mean, it ends up that way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think that we need to look at ways to increase the opportunity for multifamily and affordable housing in Cambria, as part of the mix. I understand we need to do the build out reduction. You know, we're going to be dealing with that again probably in this plan. But I wouldn't favor putting that much of the burden for build out reduction on multifamily affordable housing, given the fact that we have so little of it and we have such a great need for it.
Well, again, this
so
is...
The advisor group had something to say here.
Excuse me. I did just want to weigh in. Ann Wyatt, Chair, North Coast Advisory Council. And I appreciate the comments of both Commissioners Gibson and Christie. And we have discussed this issue at length and also did decide to support the change to 15-unit maximum. And just as Commissioner Christie suggested, we did have a problem with that, agreeing, obviously, with the great problem of affordable housing in town and throughout the county and state. But we like the idea of maybe establishing some kind of minimum density. The reality of getting 26 units an acre, as Ms. Nader has pointed out, is slim. And so we thought maybe instituting some kind of minimum density would be maybe a more efficient or practical way of establishing the higher densities than sticking with the 26 units an acre that isn't probably very likely, as we see in this discussion of Tract 26, 226, which comes up next. We're going to see some neighborhood opposition and some environmental constraints.
Did you have a suggested minimum in mind?
Well, we thought maybe for some areas, 15 minimum might be a way to go. I don't know how practical that is. We didn't decide on some number, but that seemed a more efficient or practical a way of meeting the need for higher densities than the higher maximum that we weren't likely to reach.
But let me go back to what Martha was saying. You know, we're changing the CZLUO is where it says 26 for parcels greater than an acre and 15 for parcels less. That's the standard RMF densities elsewhere in the coastal zone?
Yeah, that's specific to the North Coast area.
That's the North Coast area plan. Okay. Areas. And I think and the need to take at least some amount of a cut at reducing from 11,000 possible dwelling units down toward what the current plan is talking about at 6. I mean, it's a two or three different interests that are trying to be balanced here, and I think that this does an acceptable job in balancing it. Now, whether we want to put in some kind of guideline, you know, I don't know, again, as to a minimum density. I mean, I think as a maximum density, this works practically for Cambria. If we want to add some kind of guideline to minimum density, that might be useful. But I think it really does have to be conditioned on all these various site-specific kinds of issues that we're going to bump up against when we try to put RMF, or when we hope to see RMF come into Cambria.
I agree with Commissioner Gibson and the advisor group. I'm kind of like leaving it as it is. As to the issue of, not as it is, as proposed, Commissioner Christie is absolutely right. If we could improve this, we would better our affordable housing situation, perhaps. However, given all the resource constraints and the slopes and eshes and stuff, that's going to be rather problematic. I recall last week we had a project when Napomo had a minimum and a maximum density of 10, and that was kind of flat land, and that was pretty hard to squeeze in. I can really see that putting a minimum and a maximum in Cambria would be a little difficult.
Just a thought just occurred, and again, we're talking about constraints on resources, water the one we talk about the most. But would it make sense, and I'd ask for staff's comment on this, to put a clause in there that the density might be increased for affordable housing projects, since the source of water for those projects might be through the visitor serving set-aside and wouldn't compete with the other dwelling units. So
it's basically a density bonus for affordable.
Don't we have one already?
The state.
Isn't Mr.
Staff could respond, but I believe we already have a density bonus provision.
Would the 15 unit per acre cap as the standard, would that make it more difficult, or would that create conflicts with the density bonus?
I think the density bonus allows you to go over that.
I think
somebody from staff, please respond.
Yeah, the density bonus would allow you to go over, and there's also a density bonus offered through the state, which I think developers could utilize as well.
Okay.
And are we clear that applies in the coastal zone?
Yes, there's a specific, it's in the CZLUO.
Okay.
It's state law that provides statewide.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, John, you've got planning staff. The only another area we can give you a little bit of comfort is the next standard on number 3 or 2 down below where it says required findings. I mean, we do take a shot at, I mean, right now under the current regulations, and it happens more often than you'd think, people do propose single-family residences on a multifamily property. And this standard will take away that as an option, and I think that's a good idea, which is why we're recommending it.
Okay. I got some questions on that, but we're going we're going to deal with one first.
Okay.
So, Mr. Gibson, you were suggesting leaving.
I'm suggesting leaving. I think the density bonus handles our issues there.
Okay, and I can agree with that. Can we make it unanimous?
Six gives us more flexibility, but I'll you know.
We appreciate that. We appreciate that, since it takes three of us to make anything happen. Am I right, Mr. Counsel?
Well, this is a tentative vote, so the final vote takes three.
Okay, height limitation. Are we happy with that one?
Just doesn't reference from what? 28 feet from average natural grade, every point on the property? Does it make a difference?
It's from average natural grade, and we can clarify that.
Great.
You know, before we go on from there, I had a general question for this section. There's another RMF-zoned parcel in Cambria on Main Street, which is where the dog park is now. And I didn't see any, I know there had been some discussion about the possibility of rezoning that, but I don't see any place to discuss that here in the RMF section. So is this...
Or in the map changes, when we get to the proposed map changes?
Okay.
That's one of the proposed map changes to change.
Okay, but there's no discussion of that zoning change in this chapter.
No, there's no standard specific to that site.
Okay, so just so I can flag that, where will that conversation take place?
After Chapter 7?
Okay.
Who knows? For condos, we're going to end up with small little dwellings. Now, how's that different than a small house, and we need some small houses in this world, but it's a single-family resident, isn't it?
Right. So, for example, if you had a small lot such as those in Track 226, you would be allowed to build a single-family home because you would meet the requirement where your parcel size is less than 6,000 square feet. But there's other parcels in the neighborhood surrounding Track 226, for example, that the parcels are larger than 6,000 square feet, and rather than developing it as a duplex or a triplex, the owners have chosen, or because of other constraints, have only developed it as single family. So in there's an opportunity to develop it as multifamily because you have enough square footage of the lot, and we're trying to have those then develop as multifamily rather than single family.
Okay, so I went to an advisory group meeting last night where one of the applicants talked about affordable housing and why residential multifamily gets developed with a bunch of little houses as opposed to something that he termed would eventually be turned into an airspace condominium, and it had to do with legal issues, homeowners associations, and 10-year warranties, and lawyers came in at 7 and 8 years and said things, and so builders are very reluctant to build those things. So are we requiring that where builders don't want to build those?
So your concern is with requiring attached units versus smaller detached? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. We could write this to clarify somehow that detached units would be allowed. I guess that would come to a minimum. Sorry, I'm trying to think at the same time.
Well, while you're thinking, does anyone, Mr. Orton, perhaps know what I'm talking about, these legal issues involved with airspace condominiums?
Yeah, but I don't think it's limited to condominiums. I think you're talking about where there are latent defects. There's a 10-year statute of limitation, and I think it applies to all housing.
Right, and the where this architect explained it last night, it's particularly vulnerable where you have a homeowners association where, and here is, we all own this airspace condominium, all of us, the roof leaks over your house, but since you don't own the roof, we all own the roof, we all have to pay for it, and as opposed to if we had small little lots, each one and our own little house, we have to pay for our own roof leaks, although we still have the right to go back to the contractor 10 years for 10 years and make him fix those problems, that because there's homeowners associations involved, that we get in these legal complexities. And I'm ashamed that I can't state exactly what this architect was saying, but it made sense when he explained it, but not enough so that I could go back and re-explain it. And I was hoping somebody had a grasp of that. And we had the same thing at a California Planning Commissioners Association meeting 2 years ago where they talked about this, why people aren't building, people being builders, aren't building more apartments and condos. They want to build these little houses.
Well, I'm not sure I can provide a complete explanation of that, but I do know that there's been more litigation involved with the condominium projects. I know that a number of people who've come in with condominiums that they're required to have a homeowners association. We have a number of projects where we no longer require homeowners association, but require, which we can't do for condo projects, which by state law are required to have one, but other planned developments sometimes come in and just have maintenance done by the property owners, smaller. As far as I know, there's been concern about the litigation that's been involved with condominium projects and the disputes within a homeowners association of different interests, and it's not been a happy situation, and I think it's led to more litigation, and I think there's been a concern not to create more situations like that.
I know, well, I'm just concerned about us forcing that, and I'm not sure we are. But
We certainly approve our share of new condominium projects at this commission.
True.
You know, it's not like they're not building them. I know there have been some attempts to deal with the scenario that you referenced. I'm concerned with number three here, required findings, limitations on use, is everything after the line, except as part of a caretaker's quarters for a larger multifamily project. I look at basically the rest of that paragraph as basically loopholes that are designed primarily to apply to 226 to allow single-family residences to be built on multifamily zoning. And so I think it would just be a lot cleaner and a lot more direct to simply say you can't build single-family dwellings on multifamily, on MFR zoning, except as a caretaker's quarters as part of a multifamily project, period. And I think that will add incentive to the various property owners that are associated with Track 226 to come to some kind of holistic conclusion to their problems there. And I think it will just send an unequivocal message that on areas that are zoned multifamily, that's what we expect to be built there, period. So if you want to build a single-family residence, don't buy multifamily-zoned land and try to, like, work the angles to make your single-family house happen.
But what if it's just a little bitty lot?
Well, build a duplex.
Let's take 226 aside, because it has, we'll talk about it, but it's proposed to have a development plan where all that would be addressed. Martha or anybody, do we have a sense of how many lots would fall into the 6,000 square foot? I mean, we've got a few scattered around in that area. Any more? I mean, what's the magnitude that we're talking about here?
It's hard to say because many of the area zoned RMF have small underlying lots, but with ownership patterns, without mapping out those specific ownership patterns, it's hard to say what's consolidated. And also, if someone owns a large number of those small lots, zoned multifamily, there's that opportunity to do some re-subdivision and rearranging of those lots. So.
I think Mr. Hofshire could help us out here.
Thank you, John Hofshire, County Planning Staff. There's Track 226 has the potential of 28 homes over 33 lots, and that's because some of them ended up getting combined. The problem we're trying to solve
standard three is the same as what your commission is talking about, is that we're designating a finite amount of land in this plan that we expect to develop in a multifamily fashion. There is a problem with that in that some of the land is already subdivided into small lots, and the county requires 6,000 square feet, which would be, what, 4 or 5 lots before you can get your duplex. Given the, and that's part of that is just physically you can't get the unit on the lot. And a good example, and you had the map of track 226 up, some of these people only own a 25-foot lot, so are you going to require that they physically try to fit 2 units on one? Because it won't, the county's laws prohibit that, and good design and practical considerations would stop that. What we're doing here is we're requiring findings. We're not saying that the people on 226, if they only own one lot, if it's RMF, we're not saying that you can't do that. We're just saying that somebody needs to make some intelligent findings that there's no reasonable or feasible way to develop the site into multifamily. And that's because of ownership patterns and pre-existing situations. Now, this was really written for these large pieces, and currently there's a 14-acre site that is allowed for 26 units per acre in Cambria. That's a lot of units. It's hundreds of units. We didn't want to see that land wasted in a classic single-family half-acre lot subdivision that was sold because that was the highest and best use from a market standpoint. We wanted that to actually be there and be available for development in apartments, in small condominiums, in something more affordable, or in the in those types of ranges. So this is what we're trying to do here. And remember that we're just requiring a finding, a consideration to be there before we allow a single-family dwelling in one of these areas.
John, there's another option, isn't there, for those single lot owners that, you know, you're saying, can you try to squeeze a duplex onto that parcel? They could sell that parcel to an adjoining property owner, and then there would be a viable project there. I mean, it's not... You know, that's not the only option to try and squeeze a multifamily project onto a 25-foot lot. They could sell it.
That's possible.
I mean, we can't zone for the needs of every individual property owner in the planning area.
And, again, let me just take a stab. If we take 226 out of the picture here, because it's going to receive its own treatment in one way or another, how many residential multifamily lots, I mean, just even ballpark, might fall into this category?
Boy, that would be difficult to without seeing the map just, in front of us.
Right.
Remember that part of Cambria that's designated multifamily, that would be this part, East Lodge Hill, and there's some pieces right across the highway from this that are zone multifamily now, and they're right there in the curve at the lower part of Highway 1. There's some multifamily in there.
It's difficult there because there's sort of like three shades of red.
There's
sort of a coral color, isn't it?
Kind of in the neighbor of Ardeth, where Ardeth and Highway 1 meet, a little bit lower, Martha, right in there. You got it. There's small lot subdivisions. They're pre-existing ownerships. What you're suggesting is to get 6,000 square feet, you're going to need 4 to 5 of these small lots. Mm-hmm. And in Cambria, that could mean you pretty much requiring 2 to 3 owners getting together and developing as one. And then, of course, you're going to end up with an increased build-out.
Or sell. Well, people sell their lots all the time to adjacent lot owners. You don't have to get together to do a development. You can say, you know what, I don't want to build on this lot, and I'm going to sell it to you, and then you can build on it.
Let me back up. Let me suppose that it actually reduces build-out. It could reduce build-out. Suppose those were 2,000-square-foot lots, each of which could sustain a single-family home under the exception that's granted in this. But in order to build it multifamily, you'd need to put 3 of those together to build a duplex. So you'd actually have reduced your build-out in that regard. And I guess the other place I'm going with this is it doesn't seem to me that there are a huge number outside of Track 226, special case. But outside of that, it doesn't seem to be a huge number. And if we were to put this standard in, striking the language that Commissioner Christie is proposing to strike, the process of a variance is always open to those who would want to come forward with that.
That's correct. And again, we're making findings here. We're just throwing a step here in the analysis that we want some consideration by the hearing officer or your commission that there's no feasible way in a given situation to develop multifamily. And again, that's that example of the 14 acres, and it's coming right in for a large lot subdivision, and you really expected apartments and condos there. Again, it's going to force that consideration to ask that question: why is there no feasible alternative that this could be developed?
But doesn't this language cover the 14 acre issue? Right,
yes, it does.
It does. So, I mean, I would propose that we do go ahead and strike this language, treat Track 226 on its own accord, and require the variance proceedings that it, and if indeed you had one multifamily lot of 3,000 square foot or 3,750 multifamily lot that's in the midst of otherwise single family residences and somehow has a water meter that they can attach to that lot, that they would need the variance process to show that there's reason to proceed along those lines.
So are you proposing that we strike everything starting from or when the parcel size is less than 6,000 square feet? Just strike the rest of the paragraph?
Because that's what she proposed.
That's what I was proposing.
Well, I'm just reading to get the implications of error. I mean, certainly the or where the parcel size is less.
That would do what you both, I hear two commissioners saying that would result in that.
With striking the rest of the paragraph.
Yeah, yeah. Starting with or where the parcel size.
Because
Okay, if you got agreement on it, let's let.
I would do that, and
I'll support it if the staff says we're not setting ourselves up. I heard you say that their regulations won't permit this.
Well, you're basically saying that you're forcing a finding. The hearing officer will have to make a finding when he looks at that single house on an RMF lot that there's no feasible way to develop the site in multifamily.
Right, that's what the existing wording.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the proposal is to do away with that.
Why not strike just the or where to the end of that sentence?
Because that's still going to set up a scenario wherein there will be requests for single-family dwellings to be built on RMF zoning, and the planning director will make a determination. And, you know, I have every confidence and every reason to believe that those findings will be made at the administrative level, that for whatever reason...
Is that the one we really want to refer to here? Is that the best graph you can come up with?
We could add another graphic, but it is actually the correct one. And figure 7.1 under the legend F is tract 226. And what this shows is the tract in relation to the rest of Cambria.
Okay.
Just
the one you had on earlier in the day seemed a lot better.
Well, there's one on 7.23 on 7.59 shows it in pretty good scale as well. I don't know how big a deal it is to change that graphic. It's the one that's referencing the Patrick House bed and breakfast, but 226 is right below the Patrick House there.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
We can add another figure in.
We'll just swap it out. Just change 7, make it 723, and put a little highlighting in there. Okay, we dealt with that one. How about the following standards 5 and 6? We need to change that. The following standards 1, 2, and 3, or just the following standards?
Following standards.
Following standards, so we're scratching 5 and 6. Okay. Now, do we in fact want to rezone this? Or are we waiting for that until we consider the maps?
No. I'll forge ahead here at some risk. I mean, to me, the question of what land use category this should have is really, it almost boils down to a process of elimination here. It's commercial service right now. That doesn't make sense in a residential neighborhood. Open space I have difficulty with because whereas it might allow residential use, that isn't the purpose of open space zoning. Now, that's not to argue that this shouldn't be open space. I mean, if this tract were to be taken through a land conservancy project and end up with as a park in Cambria, I think that fits some of the goals of the plans to have residential parks. But I don't think we're in a good position to demand that it go to open space and by that leverage that to occur.
I'm agreeing with you so far.
So residential single family, that doesn't make particular sense to me because it doesn't make a whole lot of difference according to what we heard from Mr. Hofshore. In the final disposition, and I think as Commissioner Christie points out, it might make it even more difficult to pursue a conservancy deal if that's the way. Industrial doesn't make sense to me, but that's just being facetious, and we don't have time for that. So it seems to me that in this area, the residential multifamily is the appropriate land use category to assign this. It's consistent with the neighborhood. Now, having said that, I'm sensitive to the...
Okay, so before you go too far, are we of a consensus that residential multifamily makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I agree with that.
Without prejudice to an ultimate open space arrangement.
Open space arrangement. And again, having said that, I am sensitive to what residents of the area have brought forward as their concerns. I think that what staff has proposed here and the unique nature of the ownership pattern on that tract works together to probably give us the best chance of seeing a reasonable resolution of. Now, it may be unlikely, but that's based on the current situation and the current pattern of ownership and current attitudes. But if we demand through this standard, if we establish that we need to do a development plan for this tract, it produces the highest level of consideration in the permitting process. The ownership pattern de facto requires, as we've heard from Mr. McNulty, requires a consensus view for the owners of the land that's affected. The development plan would be undertaken explicitly to look at those impacts that the neighbors and the other residents have ranged. Noise, traffic, runoff, drainage plans, the necessity for open space, the appropriate density of housing, all these things seem to be wrapped up in the development plan. So, after looking for how you might change what's being proposed here, I come to the conclusion that it's pretty much the best we can do.
But what about, as Mr. Belcher and our own lawyer pointed out, that one or two property owners then have veto power, and so nothing will happen?
I think that looks at the negative. That's the glass half empty. I think that the issues raised demand that consensus be reached, and to get any resolution.
Granted, both of them would need to accomplish these bullets that you have written down here.
John Euphrat, planning staff. I mean, there is a significant difference, and it's a really a higher level of review if you go to the specific plan, if you were to mandate it. If you were to make it an or, I think that there's ample flexibility and there could be advantages for the property owners to do a specific plan. But the big difference is that it would require the Board of Supervisors' approval, and probably the Coastal Commission's as well, right? It would. So I think our suggestion...
Does it get us out of this one property owner has veto power thing?
I think either way you're okay on that. With the subdivision, you have the veto power, but not in terms of a land use approval. I think you're okay. So I think our recommendation would be to leave it as development plan to avoid... an additional level of review and an LCP amendment.
I think an additional level of review is a good thing. I mean,
It's complicated enough as it is, though, and this language has been in place for...
He's messy, Mr. Euphrat. It's an opportunity for the public to participate and the issues to be discussed and the board to make the ultimate policy.
Well, it'd be actually the state and the board working together, and I'm not sure that's appropriate.
They have the mechanisms.
The local government work together all the time.
What would be the appeal on a development plan? Presumptively, that gets appealed. Appealable all the way to the Coastal Commission.
Absolutely.
So if it can be settled at the lowest level, and I think the driving issue here is consensus of the landowners.
That's what we're trying to get to.
You know, and normally I would endorse the idea that a subset of landowners could come in, but the configuration of these lots and the undivided interest of that open parcel, or that 34th parcel. It just seems to me that good planning demands that whole tract be dealt with. It's not a large piece of property.
I could not agree more. I think the whole thing needs to be re-subdivided and a master plan needs to be prepared, and I think it needs to have full public review. And I hate to be a pessimist. I'm skeptical that it's actually going to happen because you know, we've heard loud and clear that some of the owners of those parcels are not interested at all in seeing that parcel get developed. And I don't blame them. And they're pursuing the open space alternative, and maybe that will work out. In terms of your process of elimination, I agree. I think this site makes sense for multifamily. I'd like to see it happen there. I'm going to support the recommended changes in the plan, but I also think ultimately it's going to need a little bit more county intervention to actually make it happen if we're serious about seeing multifamily developed on that parcel.
Would you be amenable to adding or specific plan after the words development plan?
Yeah, give them some flexibility there if that's the route they choose to go.
Or is fine by me, but I tend to like the development plan approach, and I would think that I don't imagine that the second half of that or is going to get executed given the increased complication.
Well, we had one property owner request that, so I agree with you.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question for Mr. Euphrat. If they're processing a development plan, what are you going to require for consent of landowner if, say, one of the lots, are you going to require unanimous consent of all the landowners in order to process a development plan? Or
no.
Normally, to do a subdivision, you've got to have an ownership in the property, but for a development plan, you normally require consent of landowner, and you know that could be a problem. So I thought maybe you could explain what you had in mind.
John Euphrat, the subdivision clearly, I think as previously stated, you would need everyone because ultimately, even if the county took action on it without all the property owners' concurrence, you could never record the map. You know, you would have to have signatures there. So that's mandatory, no question about it. Development plan, though, we believe we have a little bit more flexibility, and if we have the majority of the owners, it's such a complicated situation, and the majority of the owners are bringing forward a solution, we would be willing to bring it to your commission. And then you're going to hear at that point, if there is a minority of folks that aren't interested, that they're going to let you know, and ultimately we would let you make that decision. But we think it would be appropriate to bring it forward if there's a majority of the owners that concur that there was an application that could be considered.
Just as a practical matter, what good is a development plan without a re-subdivision? I mean...
Well, they could be developed. I mean, I think we heard from Mr. Belcher, and there's others, that those lots are legal lots and could be developed as they are today, frankly, with commercial uses, subject to the standards.
So we could essentially see a development plan come forward that's just a series of duplexes.
Sure. I think that's what we've heard we may see from...
About, and it'd be good to hear what that is.
Right. The simple answer on that is that the Coastal Commission wanted this to be a residential single family in its entirety. And if that was okay, then you wouldn't need the standard under multifamily.
Okay.
Okay, now we're going to residential single family, and we're starting the hearing again. Ms. Nieder. And we it's our goal to get some public comment in, because I know at least a couple people don't really want to come back. They want to say their say and stop spending all this gas money.
Thank you, Commissioners. Martha Nader, County Planning. The residential single-family land use category standard section starts with some general requirements related to application content, topographic standards, erosion control, height limitations, and standards specific to Moonstone Beach. This section also includes standards related to building size. The majority of Cambria is within the residential single-family land use category, and the majority of it consists of small lot subdivisions. The massive appearance of homes on these lots and the impact to the Monterey Pine Forest has long been a concern in the community. In the existing plan, Table G attempts to address visual impacts, drainage, and impacts to the Monterey Pine Forest of development in the Lodge Hill area of Cambria by limiting the allowable footprint and gross structural area. In this area that has these limitations, you are allowed to increase the footprint and gross structural area by a limited amount by purchasing transfer of development credits, or TDCs. And the money from these TDC purchases go to acquiring land in specific sensitive resource areas called Fern Canyon and the Visual Hillsides. So what this public hearing draft proposes is replacing the existing Table G with Table 7-1. And 7-1 would apply to all areas subdivided in 25-foot lots rather than just Lodge Hill. The allowable footprint in Table 7-1 is also different from Table G in that the allowable footprint is increased by the base number of transferred development credits that you would be able to purchase. The gross structural area stays the same, and the intent behind this was Table G right now, most of the standards allow just double the amount of square footage for gross structural area. For instance, if the allowable footprint was 1,000 square feet, the allowable gross structural area would be 2,000 square feet. And what this has caused, since people oftentimes try to maximize square footage, it results in these kind of boxy, massive appearance homes. So in order to allow for a little more first floor living or development, that was one of the proposed changes in this plan. In addition to revising Table G, planning area standards are added and revised to reduce this massive appearance of homes and try to retain the small-scale character of development in Cambria. In some areas, the setbacks are increased, and then in other areas in the plan, which in the revised Chapter 7 that was handed out, there's some standards that were proposed in the public hearing draft that are proposed for deletion, and these have to do with second-story setbacks. What we did in response to community concern over the massive development is got a little out of hand with proposed standards for second-floor setbacks and things that didn't really apply to Cambria. We used some examples from Cayucas small-scale neighborhood standards, which work well in Cayucas in the areas that typically are flat without sloping lots. But when we looked at how this would really actually affect development in Cambria, it didn't translate given the nature of the lots there. So we revised some standards related to building face height and went to, once you get to a certain building face height, you would have to step back the second story. So we've attempted to address that and taken a second swipe at that. And then finally, residential design criteria that were developed through the draft residential design plan are incorporated into the planning area standards. And that concludes staff's comments on the residential single-family standards.
Okay, and before we get to Commissioner's comment, my thought was I have a couple of additional speaker slips, and I just recycled the ones that I previously got. If you didn't wish to speak, fine. But if you hadn't put one in, please be so kind as to do so. Okay. Commissioner, comments? Questions? Oh, come now. Okay. Then I'll open up the public comment period. We're discussing residential single family. And this goes from all the way down to page 787 on mine. And starting with 762 on the new.
First speaker I have is Dale Robinson.
Square foot home. And by the way, there's 2,000 square foot GSA allowable on table 7-1. If we think of a 2,000 square foot home, that sounds pretty comfortable. But when realtors talk about a 2,000 square foot home, they're talking about living area, excluding the garage, and measured to the inside face of wall. but when you go to the definition of GSA here, there's not enough room to get a three-bedroom, two-car garage home in 2,000 square feet of GSA. And so we're going to be forced to make that choice. And there's a lot of ramifications of having houses with one-car garages that is not going to be positive for Cambria. Cambria can't really handle having cars parked on the street. The streets are too narrow. Further, it's not really shown in this plan how having this limited GSA is really related to the rest of the goals of the plan, particularly how it impacts the forest. So what I'd like to ask you to do is allow just an additional 200 square feet of in the basic allowable GSA that allows you to get the basic three-bedroom, two-car garage house. In addition, I'd like to ask you to exempt 200 square feet of GSA or 200 square feet of basement from the allowable GSA to allow people to put in some storage space so they don't have to use their garage for storage. I'd also like to ask you to not automatically penalize GSA for someone who has one tree on their lot if they're able to show that their design is sensitive to that tree and allows it to stay. And lastly, I'd like you to consider more ways to get TDCs because we are allowed to get an additional 300 square feet of GSA by purchasing TDCs, which is great, but under the present scenarios, there's not enough TDCs to go around. So we're going to need to identify some more potential sender areas. If that can be done, we would support that process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tammy Clark, followed by the Susies. You wish to speak on this issue? Okay. So then that would be Barbara Shippey, if she's still here. No, she's not here. Anyways, Tammy Clark? Evidently, she's not here. So the Susies are, and Ms. Shippey, Joy Fitzhugh, and Robert Rippey.
Yes, Joy Fitzhugh, just real quick one. It relates to page 782. I think one of the problems we're having in Cambria, because you have multiple families in houses, is parking. And we're finding that our streets are receiving a lot of cars that some of them have been parked there and haven't been moved for weeks. And as this relates a little bit, this is a personal thing because as we pull our stock trailers out or our flatbed trailer out, sometimes we have difficulty going down the street because there's cars parked on both sides because there are multiple families in the same house. And I don't know how you would address this under the parking and access standards, but I think there needs to be something. I haven't figured it out how you deal with that, but it is a growing problem in Cambria and in the area bordering Cambria. Thank you.
Thank you. Robert Rippey?
I have nothing on that.
All right, thank you. That's the last speaker slip I have for residential single family. Going once, twice. I'll close the public hearing, bring back to the commission for plotting our way through here.
I wonder if there are any thoughts from the advisory council in general, especially on GSA, which I bet you've discussed some.
We have, yes.
Just maybe we could wait till we get there.
Okay.
Section by section.
Okay.
I'll chime in.
So it'll be fresh.
Okay.
But do you have any general comments that you wanted to add?
I'll chime in as we get to this.
Okay. Appreciate that. Okay, we're on page 762 of the new standard here and permit requirement. Secondary dwellings?
Yes, we did have a comment on secondary dwellings. Just we weren't convinced of the need that secondary dwellings be attached to the residence, the primary residence, and the code also calls for a second story only of garages or attached to the primary residence. So council wasn't convinced of the necessity of that and would prefer to see that secondary dwellings be allowed detached from the house and the garage. And they're also within a maybe 50-foot proximity as something is currently required. I think in your guest house ordinance currently requires the guest house to be within 50 feet. So if somehow that serves some need, we thought that could also work for the secondary dwelling unit. And also the
goal was to reduce site disturbance, but I don't think that just having the 50-foot location requirement would make a big difference. We'd be fine with that.
I would support that. And that 50 feet has a basis in some ordinance somewhere, doesn't it?
The guest house standards.
All right.
I kind of liked it the way staff had it. I think anything we can do to reduce site disturbance is probably a good thing. It minimizes tree removal and erosion impacts. And
I guess I would split the difference on that. I tend to think that's true. I think that the attached is to be preferred, unless it can be shown that maybe it is that by detaching it you could minimize site disturbance. You know, you had a tree. If you were to attach a secondary unit to a house, and it would require the removal of a tree, whereas if you put it out 20 feet, maybe it doesn't. So, I would vote for the flexibility. And if we want to make reference in here to, that secondary units shall be sited so as to minimize site disturbance, I think that would be appropriate.
I agree with that.
Yeah, or something maybe. Shall be attached or located within 50 feet of the existing dwelling, whichever causes the least environmental disturbance.
That would be fine.
Sure. Application content. Which contains contour map, architecture elevations, vegetation, streetscape, design criteria compliance, additional contents, oceanfront lot development.
I've got an issue with F.
On oceanfront lot?
Yeah.
Anything before that? Okay, we're at the oceanfront lots. F.
It says new development shall be compatible with the character of the surrounding neighborhood and protect public views from the road. We've just had a court case come down in San Luis Obispo County that affirms the need to protect public views of the coast from the sea. And I would also maintain that there could be views from East West Ranch or Camp Ocean Pines or other areas that aren't associated with a road. So I propose amending that to just say to protect public views, period, from wherever they may be. I mean, that would be the implication.
This seems reasonable. That precludes individual lot owners saying you're messing up my view,
right.
But if it's
right.
From the ocean, it's...
Right, right. And I don't think the view from the ocean is not going to apply in the residential single-family areas of Cambria. That issue was specific to a relatively undeveloped stretch of coast.
But this is
coast,
oceanfront lot development.
Yeah,
but, I mean, the point is there's public views that aren't
right.
From roads, so...
That's fine.
Right. Works for me.
Okay,
we're finishing that on to... Item 4, topographic standards.
You got something on that one, Bruce?
Viewporters.
My notes here is just that this is yet another reason to designate a visual or scenic SRA in this plan. We're talking about protecting public view corridors that have been identified on, the circulation map and, determined by the planning director, et cetera, et cetera. We had agreed that we would talk somewhere in Chapter 7 about standards that would, be the equivalent of combining designations to protect scenic views. And I'm just waiting for that to happen. And maybe this is where it happens, or maybe it happens somewhere else in Chapter 7. But...
Well, we did talk about it in the community-wide standards for development within view of Highway 1.
That's just within view of Highway 1. But there's been a call in both the periodic review and the North Coast Area Plan update that we should designate, we should have a scenic combining designation that could be applied to areas around Cambria and San Simeon that would, you know, trigger a visual analysis when development is proposed in those areas. And my recollection was when we talked about it earlier in the plan that we said, well, we're going to talk about that in Chapter 7. There may be standards that are there that, you know, accomplish the same thing, et cetera. But it hasn't happened yet. So
my question is, we don't have one?
No.
Well, I mean, actually, what we have are the standards that we believe are the equivalent of what Commissioner Christie just discussed, and your commission's already reviewed those and taken tentative action, but we can go back and look at those whenever you'd like. It's in the area-wide standards. But it is not just automatically designated an SRA, which can be for the purpose of protecting visual.
Right. And we could do that in this plan.
We could, absolutely.
Go beyond that in extending it to the collector and arterials.
Okay.
I don't see what you're talking about, Commissioner Gibson.
Well,
new development screened from Highway 1 in accordance with criteria below. So we're screening it from Highway 1.
Right.
And then we're talking about landform alterations, location of buildings, Highway 1 frontage. Where's the collector and arterial?
No, what I'm saying is that what we're considering on 764 takes basically that same idea and extends it to views from the collector roads.
It does, but we don't have a mapped area where we have a combining designation that says on this area there's a visual resource combining designation that will trigger this additional level of review. It's sort of left up to a sort of catch-as-catch-can, individual case-by-case determination. We may have a different planning director. The person may be sick that day. You know, it's kind of ambiguous.
But if we draw some big broad-brush map, we're going to make more of the problems we have to deal with at the end of today, where we had this combining designation, and there was evidence that... You know what I'm talking about?
That became a problem for other reasons, so I wouldn't look
at that. But I mean that issue that evidently, you know, the combining designation may or may not apply to that little particular square foot of ground, and I could see little complications in drawing a map and covering everything without having an inordinate amount of work to make it extremely accurate.
You know, I guess the matter of what we're talking about is viewshed protection.
Yes, absolutely.
And my experience with our county's plan is that viewshed protection is primarily a matter of relatively undeveloped areas. That's where it's been applied first and foremost. It's a matter of things like the stretch of Highway 1 north of Cayucas, the one that's in process for the critical viewshed in back of Cayucas. Those are the ones I'm most familiar with. And I think the presumption is that within an urban reserve line, we are expecting development to have, if you will, compromised the viewshed. But it has, you know, it has, outside of an urban reserve line, your viewshed protection is to prevent as much development as you can from intruding on what is nominally a natural view. I think the rationale is a little different once you step inside the urban reserve line, because by drawing that line and by doing the designations of land use within the URL, you are expecting that you're not going to have a natural view there. So I think the goals of viewshed protection within a URL, which is what we're talking about here, are properly addressed with the one we had there, which was what happens when you're going to build any kind of structure within view of Highway 1. You should take a certain amount of care. But you'll notice that in there you're not demanding that that project be hidden from Highway 1 necessarily. It might need to be screened from Highway 1, but you're not talking about a view of a natural area. You're talking about the urban area of Cambria. And I think that the rationale extending into the residential single family, because we're talking a very specific and a very large piece of Cambria, with what we're talking about, land alteration, how to treat the forest, how to, you know, minimize the visual impacts of retaining walls as seen from public spaces, I think we're doing about as well as we can in terms of minimizing the infill development, if you will, from there. And I agree with Commissioner Rose that the drawing the sensitive resource areas on the map does impose a level of complication that I don't think is necessarily warranted within a URL. Outside a URL, I think absolutely we can make that case.
You know, I agree with you about the differing levels or the differing standards of protection of visual resources within and without urban areas. Absolutely. I guess I don't see a combining designation as adding an onerous level of additional work for county staff or applicants to have to go through, because it's a question of what we make as a standard in terms of properties having to meet when they fall under that SRA. Are we going to require a full-blown visual analysis? Are we going to require, you know, 100% screening like they do in Big Sur? And I, certainly that's not what I had envisioned, and it wasn't what I was proposing. I guess I see a combining designation as an added safety measure to make sure, you can never be sure of anything, but to lessen the likelihood that properties are going to fall through the cracks for whatever reason because they didn't get flagged as having the visual impacts that they ultimately had once it's when the building goes up and it's too late to do anything about it. So, you know, if it's appropriate to
do, I'd be interested in staff's take, because at one point, some time ago, you made the differentiation between accomplishing that within an SRA and accomplishing it with a series of standards that are specific. And it seems to me that the applicability of these standards is very clear if it is in within view of here, here, and here. But if you could outline that again, I'd be interested.
Sure. I'll start, and Ms. Nieder may jump in too. But and in fact, you know, because Commissioner Christie brought this up several hearings ago, and so we did take a look at the idea of mapping it, and it was very problematic. I mean, we have to remember, as Commissioner Gibson mentioned, as part of your commission's action on Estero, we did the same thing, but again, the mapping was only in the rural areas where it's much easier to accomplish. But our topographic information is really not good enough at a fine enough level of detail to do any good within the urban area, particularly in Cambria, where the lots are 25 to 50 foot wide. And so I think by doing the broad brush map, unless you did it just as a figure, but we would not support really the combining designation, because the level of accuracy wouldn't be good enough for that purpose, number one. And number two, it does place, by doing so, a fair amount of additional requirement on the property owners. It's not just a small thing. It would then elevate it to an automatic public hearing and a minor use permit at a minimum. Although in Cambria, most development requires that anyway, but not just, we wouldn't want to do it just because of a broad brush map that wasn't that accurate. We believe, I mean, this is a huge issue for us when we're doing land use permitting in Cambria, is the view shed. We know it's important to the community. We know it's important to the public and the Coastal Commission. And so we treat it very seriously, and that's why we had the language. We think it covers the issue.
The palm trees in North Cambria, were those within the...
That's a rural area.
That was there. In a rural area? That was
but that's, you know, something that was determined to be inconsistent with something that, on the State Coastal Commission permit.
Right.
And did not fall through the cracks.
Right.
They did not.
Yeah.
No way. I think...
It was a pretty big fish.
They got pulled up.
And that's been awfully big crack.
Well, yeah. All I'll say is that I hope that when the rest of the North Coast... area plan comes before the
absolutely
for review, that staff is supportive of combining a new scenic and visual resource, combining that
absolutely
for the rural areas and creating a map to go along with
it. We would do very similar, which is that to what we did in Estero, which did exactly what you're suggesting.
Okay. Leaving land alteration within view quarters as is, minimize extent of evacuation fill.
We've got a potential summit. Potential language to add.
On which one?
On B, to minimize the extent of excavation and fill. Right now the language reads, impervious surfaces such as driveways and walkways shall be limited to the smallest functional size, and I would propose adding something along the lines that says, and shall utilize porous materials or designs when feasible, just to get away from the, you know, automatic hardscape kind of design reflex.
Works for me.
Yeah, aside from the fact that the sentence starts with impervious and ends up with porous and permeable. I mean, I think that does that want to just as a matter of logical consistency.
Maybe we say hardscape, hard surfaces such as driveways. Because it can be a hard surface and still utilize porous materials.
How about just driveways and walkways shall be limited to the smallest functional size?
There you go.
With permeable.
What about patios?
Yeah, whatever you want to. Okay. How about surfaces such as driveways, walkways, and patios?
Okay.
Shall be limited to the smallest functional size.
And shall utilize porous materials.
And shall to the greatest extent possible.
Did staff get all that?
Mm-hmm.
I had a little trouble with adding patios there.
No, there
it's not a deal breaker, but just think about it.
Well, it's
okay. That's a pretty nebulous argument.
That's a nebulous one, but it also is something that adds to runoff.
Oh, absolutely, it does. Okay,
which we get to on the next page here, and I have
okay. I'll let it go. Okay. Moving on. Minimize the visual impacts retaining walls. Nothing there. Good. Erosion control.
I had a question in one, and it just seemed a little bit of an inconsistency. All runoff from impervious surfaces, such as shall be collected and retained on site. And then the next sentence starts: runoff not able to be retained on site, etc. So the question is: do we put where feasible, or is there some conditional that we want to put on that first sentence?
Where feasible, I think, would take care of that.
I mean,
and why did
have a question with this where feasible thing. I mean, you guys deal with this more than we do on a permit-by-permit basis. Don't applicants always come in and say it's, you know, this isn't feasible because it just doesn't fit with their design plan or it's going to be more expensive?
Unlikely at the very least from a practical standpoint.
No.
Am I missing something in new residential?
I got to get back to the retain-detain here and... Public Works isn't here. Somebody give me that. Which one keep it there forever and which one we allow it to run off at the historical rate?
John Yefred, I believe detained is the one that is temporary and retained would be more permanent. And I think Commissioner Gibson's right. It's not practical, particularly on small properties like this, that they be retained on site.
I just wanted to add, I think the important thing is that it's either going to be retained on site or it's going to be put into a system that's been approved by the Public Works Director. If it's not one of those, the county could be liable for inverse condemnation.
What about the, we heard some testimony that an existing culvert is too small, so can that weigh into the fact, this culvert is too small, so therefore... you're causing a problem by allowing it to happen. Therefore, you need to go back to the detain option.
Well, I was looking at drainage system approved by the county engineer. If it's too small to be retained on site, there's got to be some way to take care of it.
And maybe we can get rid of it as feasible by rewording it to say shall be collected and retained on site or... pass through an effective erosion control device approved by the county engineer. I mean, then you got to do one or the other.
Right. Which is basically the way it was before. And
if Mr. Marshall were here, he would ask us to change county engineer to Public Works Department.
And we'll, in deference to the sick man, we'll do that.
And I would suggest adding another, adding D7. That basically would echo the amendment we just took and say something along the lines of impervious surfaces shall be minimized by the use of semi-porous materials when feasible.
Oh.
That's already a requirement. You just made that a requirement.
That's
so we don't want to add that under erosion control?
That was right in...
Because we have it under minimizing excavation and fill.
And you're subject to it, so there really isn't a need to repeat it.
So So before we leave this, have we addressed Ms. Fitzhugh's concerns to strengthen this? I'm not sure we have.
Well, but that I think that relates more to whether the county's public works are adequate to handle what's happened in subsequent years.
I see Mr. Goodwin is here. Maybe he can help us out here. He was listening to the radio, and I thank you for that.
Mike Goodwin, Public Works.
First thing is retain, detain. Which is which?
Retain is to keep, basically drink every drop of water. Detain is to slow down. I liken it to if you get stopped by the police for drunken driving, they're going to detain you overnight.
And let you sort of dribble out the next day.
Okay. So what we're asking for here is we're saying all shall be collected and retained on site. Is that really practical for a small single-family residence?
No. And what we frequently do, we put in what's a reverse French drain. The downspouts are piped into a perforated pipe that's buried in the ground in a gravel bed. If it fills up, it will rise to the surface and sheet flow off to the neighboring property or to the street. So we frequently have them grade the property to drain toward the street so that water goes there. We can control it a little better and it doesn't flood the neighbors.
We want
all the water, it's just
we've heard some testimony that that's not completely foolproof.
No, it's not.
But would this, these words in here, retained, you know, shall be collected and retained on site, we're seeing some, what I consider to be some rather creative things in the Pomo, where they're putting these retention basins underneath the street. And I guess the goal there, and granted we're talking the Pomo soil, not Cambria soil, to let it soak into the ground and end up in the water table.
Correct.
Is that practical in Cambria?
It works real at a low spot on the property.
Right. Well, just to disagree with you, Mr. Christie, I like the retain, the shall retain, because that makes it as the first thing that they need to construct this French drain,
right.
And they need to try. Now, granted, if we've got the shallow bedrock, you're out of luck. Now we got to go to Plan B.
I agree. I think it should be stated here that they should retain as much as they can, detain to the extent they can, and the rest has to go to approved county approved. Device that
cisterns,
down to the desal plant,
right?
They can
if they back up
it.
To a recognized water course, a stream, we let them.
I'm sorry.
I said if the property fronts on a recognized water course, a stream, there are a few through the communities, then we allow them to dump it directly into those drainage swales.
Now, Ms. Christie talked about cisterns. Is that in your bag of tricks that you would suggest to an applicant?
That's in effective use. Assuming they use that water then to irrigate, that's the purpose of the cistern. Yes, that would work well.
Well, I think my wording went in the wrong direction, actually, because I think we got to make it clear that efforts have to be made on site. And that we recognize that not everything is going to be taken care of on site, and what gets off site has to go to.
Okay, so what are you proposing now?
Well, does it come back to the retained and detained? Do we really, you know, should we go back to should we go back to all runoff from impervious surfaces shall be collected and detained?
No. I don't like that.
On retained, on site.
I like the retain
to the greatest extent feasible.
Right. Push them towards cisterns and French drains and that sort of thing.
So maybe that is to the greatest extent feasible, not just where feasible. And then runoff not able to be retained on site shall be passed through an effective erosion control. So it gives staff some teeth to demand reasonable efforts at runoff control on site, and okay. Then the rest has to go as per.
So give me that. So after retained on site, you're adding what words?
And I would just add to the greatest extent feasible.
Would you consider possible?
Possible. And runoff not, and then the same, it'll stay as a second sentence, runoff not able would remain.
Okay. Do we have three for possible?
Yeah, except I just see a little mechanical difficulty with that, because retaining on site includes the effective erosion control device or drainage system. I mean, retaining on site means using things like cisterns and French drains.
Right.
To say retained on site or passed through an effective erosion control device.
No.
Those are the devices by which you retain the water
right.
on site.
Right. Well,
so retained on site through use of effective erosion control devices.
I'm not seeing that problem. I'm seeing the first sentence says shall
right.
collected and retained, that is keep forever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To the greatest extent possible, which means now you got to break out your whole bag of tricks. You have this shallow bedrock issue.
Right.
So that brings you into the sentence.
Beyond
second
that,
sentence.
Yeah, I think it makes logical sense. Beyond that, if you can't retain it on site, you have to pass it through an effective erosion control. And are you thinking of detention
okay.
at this point?
Yeah, no, I'll go with you on that if then we can get a little bit more specific in number two, which talks about the installation of control devices.
Mm.
The mathematical problem I'm having in my head is...
Well, you said math is your weak point.
I know. But how... Mechanical, maybe that's the
okay.
word. How do you retain water on site? As a practical matter, how do you do it?
Fill up a cistern.
Put in a French drain. Have a vegetated swale. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of things that you do to retain it on site. If those top over and you're going to lose water
right.
off the site, then you've got to put it through.
Effect.
Then you've already maxed out your erosion control device and your drainage system.
No, you've maxed out your retention device. The erosion control is to say when that water leaves the property, it shall not erode.
Okay. And I'll go with you on that if we can get a little bit more specific in number two when we're talking about installation of control devices.
Perhaps and say retention and erosion control devices,
well,
shall we?
I'd like to kind of list some of them out. Erosion control devices such as French drains, cisterns.
Well, but they're not erosion control devices.
Right.
Mr. Goodwin, come on back up here.
Control.
No, those are to keep the darn stuff.
That is another matter. We just, when it leaves the property, we want it to be non-erosive, and there's a whole bag of tricks. Some are temporary. You're talking about on-site grading activities. Those would be temporary devices. Silt fences, I can't think of the name of it.
Those big straw
fiber rolls.
Yeah.
And so forth. The permanent devices would be things that would be left there after construction activities are finished and would handle mostly the runoff from the roof, the driveway, sidewalks, etc.
So as you see D2, installation of control devices, you're thinking more in terms of those kinds of temporary erosion control devices like the straw rolls and silt fences?
Installed prior to grading activities would almost always be temporary.
Okay.
A lot of erosion control devices require maintenance, and there could be quite high maintenance for a permanent device that's not designed to handle large loads. If you've denuded the ground and it's washing silt, then we'd want something like the fiber rolls silt fences. After the area has been landscaped, vegetation's reestablished, the hard devices are installed. silt traps on drop inlets for storm drains and so forth. Once a year they could, or even less maybe if it's areas well managed, they could be cleaned out, shoveled out, vacuumed out or something, and you'll get the most a yard of material out of them.
Well, then I guess I just have a question for planning staff, and that is, would it be helpful to you as in your planning duties, and it would be, would it be helpful to the public in terms of preparing for what they're going to need to be required to do? Would it be helpful to have some additional specificity in this section for applicants to be on notice that they need to consider the technologies such as cisterns, French drains, vegetative swales, et cetera, when they're considering how to deal with the runoff generated by their development?
I don't know that it would really make that big of a difference, because as the Public Works Department reviews it, they're looking at these types of methods, and as methods, you know, change or improved, I mean, there's always new methods coming on. So if we wanted to put something in parens saying, for example, this, that, or the other method, I think that would be fine, but I don't know that it makes
you know,
a huge
difference. Reason I'm kind of leaning towards doing that is because it seems that we get a lot of applications, we get a lot of projects through here that talk about just kind of, you know, deferring the drainage plan to a later date, and we don't get the opportunity to ultimately see the final drainage plan. And so if we at the planning stage are sending a message to people, these are the types of technologies that we'd like to see installed up front to reduce erosion, to reduce, you know, polluted runoff, to reduce damage to neighboring properties, it gives us an opportunity to kind of weigh in on a question that we often don't get to weigh in on because it gets made outside of our purview. That's why I would like a greater level of specificity.
So you just want to add erosion control devices such as,
mm-hmm.
and then let Mr. Goodman hand Ms. Nieder a bunch of words, and she'll add them.
And I'd encourage you to put in such as, but not limited to, because
right.
technology is okay. always evolving.
Sure.
Such as, but not limited to, and you'll give her some examples. Great.
Right. Okay.
So are we done with erosion control? Zipping on through height. Now we get to specific. Nottingham Drive, Windsor Boulevard, and Sherwood Drive. And Moonstone Beach.
Very small question on exterior building materials.
Where are we at?
Under Moonstone Beach.
Okay.
Exterior building colors and materials. Roofing should be wood appearing materials. Wood was crossed out. So was that a fire safety issue?
Yeah. Cambria Fire requested that.
Okay.
Be removed.
Okay. This doesn't preclude the use of wood. It just opens up the opportunity that you can use.
The challenge is that in Cambria, these aren't modern size lots or modern size
right.
subdivisions.
Right.
They don't have the infrastructure in place. They don't have the drainage controls. They don't have open space set aside for the pine forest or for different things. So the fact is that these lots, many of them were created in the 1920s. They're smaller lots than what are typically seen today, and these are the sizes that is felt is appropriate on these lots. There are allowances for some increases with the purchase of transfer of development credits, and I don't believe there's a shortage of them, and I can verify with the Land Conservancy, but I don't believe that's an issue of the TDCs running out. Also, what we've been noticing is that since so many, because of the water situation, many of the lots are up for sale, and many people are buying adjacent lots. Well, as you increase the size of your lot, you're able to build a larger home. And what we see come in is that oftentimes people are able to build the size of home that they desire without even purchasing TDCs.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't feel that this precludes the ability to build a large home, but it does more accurately match the size of home to the lot.
What about the proposal to allow basements, 200 square feet of basement?
Well, one of the purposes in limiting the size is to limit site disturbance and acknowledge the topographic constraints of your lot. If you're trying to dig down and build in, then that's defeating that purpose, and you're trying to take out of the hillside. As far as allowing some underfloor kind of area for storage, there are certain areas that aren't considered part of gross structural area, and that is underfloor space that's considered non-habitable through the building code. So that's under a certain feet in height. And sometimes you get that because there's building on sloping lots, and that's not included in gross structural area. So there are some exceptions such as that for
that space that could be used for storage.
Right, exactly. Sure. It just you just can't habit. It's not habitable.
Right. Well, one reason that I would not be inclined to increase the GSA is specifically because I think we want to keep the TDC program in Cambria working. We, you know, we want to continue to protect those resources by, you know, moving those development potentials off the hillsides. And to the extent that we allow a greater GSA, I think we'll have less demand on TDCs, and I wouldn't want to undermine a program that's working well there.
I would be interested in the advisory council's discussion. I'd only add that I did a little bit of comparison with the Estero Area Plan, and Martha had made reference to the small-scale neighborhood of Cambria. That's characterized by extremely small-sized lots. The GSAs that are here are comparable to what within 50 to 100 square feet before you start adding TDCs, and the small-scale neighborhood in Cambria is a vibrant and much redeveloped, much is going on there. As the lots get bigger, the allowances, and I look mostly at the typical lots, the allowances get considerable. I mean, you're looking at the potential of a 3,000 square foot house on a triple lot. It seems to me that balancing all the issues of aesthetics and forestry and the rest of it, that I'm not these aren't unusual numbers based on other things that are going on elsewhere on the North Coast, and I think the constraints of Cambria speak to that. And again, I would ask if the advisory council had any discussion of the GSA and footprint things.
Yes, thank you. We have discussed this for many years now as the residential design plan has been under discussion. And so the note is that this plan actually increases the gross structural areas and footprints a fair bit. In general, 200 feet, a couple hundred square feet. So it's a little more of a compromise. There was some argument, certainly, that the last plan called for houses that were much too small. So I think staff has bumped the numbers up. The council members are comfortable with these numbers, at the same time recognizing that there are going to be a number of people who aren't going to build the houses they want. But certainly the compromises, the desire to keep the trees and keep the small-scale kind of neighborhoods and balances intact. So we are comfortable with these numbers, certainly acknowledging that there are some property owners who would like to do more, build more.
Thank you.
Okay.
Calls out these different tracks.
What page is that on?
7-4.
Oh, page
new
7-4. New 7-4.
She's got it up.
Oh.
John Ufret, planning staff, while you're looking at that, and just to underscore for the public, I mean, the real difference is that the balance of Lodge Hill and Park Hill, as you see on the map, is dividing into 25-foot by 70-foot lots, 1,750 square feet. They're really small. And these other ones are not. They're more at the typical neighborhood size of, say, approximately 6,000 square foot or even bigger in some cases.
Well, I guess I just have to ask if our experience up until this point has been that these small 25-foot lots and double and triple lots have been developed in a pattern that is the houses are too big. Why is it that we're increasing the footprint by the allowable footprint by as much as 200 square feet?
One of the concerns that we heard from the community and specifically the advisory council is that, number one, that the population is getting older in Cambria and to allow for some more single floor living. People have troubles getting upstairs and such. The other was, again, with this massive appearance of homes, when your gross structural area is really just double of your footprint, that encourages this kind of boxy appearance. So by allowing a little more footprint, keeping the gross structural area the same, you're allowing for some flexibility.
And that's where that second story square footage shall be no greater than 70% of the first floor. That would be number 7 on the previous page. That's going to mitigate that big boxy look.
Well, that was one proposed standard that when looking back at it, it was felt that that was too restrictive.
Uh-oh, did we drop that out of the...
Yep.
That was proposed to me.
Oh, I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, I think it was good to put that in there. Why are we backing off that?
Because with the square footage limitations, it causes a lot of confusion and frustration when you say, well, you're allowed so many square feet of footprint, so many square feet of gross structural area, and here's your setback. Oh, but now there's this other setback, and it's a 70% thing. The idea was that by allowing the increased square footage on the first floor, you are allowing for articulation, and you're encouraging articulation. And then what is proposed on page 781 of your revised Chapter 7 is a standard that really addresses the development nature in Cambria as far as second floor setbacks. And the advisory council, after the public hearing draft came out with all these second floor requirements, there was so much concern that there were too many restrictions, it was too confusing, it was hard to figure out which really applied. So the council directed staff to go back and work with architects on...
Council directed staff?
The North Coast Advisory Council.
I wasn't under the impression that advisory councils could direct staff.
They asked staff. Sorry, I'll refer.
Try.
Yeah, advisory councils always try to direct staff. That's given.
They've asked staff, and staff obliged, to go back and work with some design professionals in the community and try and come up with something that met the intent of addressing this massive appearance that really spoke to the type of development that you see in Cambria. And so that's what's proposed on page 781.
And the key is that if you look at table 7.1, that the footprint is the maximum footprint is whatever it is. The gross structural area is considerably less than twice that.
Right.
And so can we agree to accept it up to and including Table 7.1?
Yes.
Do I hear another yes?
Yes.
Okay, that puts us at page 773, starting with definitions. That should be a rather slow topic.
And we'll bring this up on the 29th.
And that's... So, we need a motion to...
Please.
Continue this to September 29th.
September 29th, so moved.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. It's unanimous.
And for the public, that's 8:45 in the morning, and we'll go to 4:30 p.m. at the latest.
Okay. And with that, we're adjourned for lunch.